That sound, it's the sound of an unhappy dog. That's a sound our vet Andrew Byrne gets to hear quite a lot. He's here today to talk about managing pain in companion animals, because that's what he is. Well, he's not a companion animal, but he's a vet who deals with companion animals. And newly published global guidelines that help vets improve their assessment and treatment of pain in cats and dogs. Andrew, you're very welcome. I haven't seen you for a while, but you still look the same, I'm glad to say.
Oh, I'm glad I haven't.
So, the old dog comes in, the poor old dog is whining and it's not feeling good. And anyway, it doesn't like you anyway, because you're the vet. I don't know how dogs know, but they do know you're the vet.
Oh, they know, yeah. As soon as they turn the corner at the end of the road, they know where they're heading.
They know where they're going. They don't forget those kind of things. So, you don't know what's wrong with the dog. It's whining. It's had been involved in an accident. You can see a fracture or something like that. Where do you start?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because there's a problem. Animals are non-verbal, but like babies, so they can't talk and they can't explain what they're feeling. And this is why the World Small Animal Veterinary Association have brought together a panel of experts to gather together this document. It's really a state-of-the-art document on pain control, and been published online so it can be edited and brought up to date very easily. And recognition of pain is very important, because you say when you have an animal who can't talk and can't say they're in pain, we have to rely completely on observing their behaviour to know if they're in pain. Now, sometimes it's very obvious. So if an animal's knocked down by a car, you see the injury, or if it's whining like the awful sound we just heard there in the recording, sometimes it's obvious, but sometimes it's not at all obvious. Like very often, particularly with low grade but significant pain or with chronic pain, sometimes there's no vocalisation and very little reaction maybe when you touch the animal. So very often it just changes the way they behave. The activity level, for example, might change slightly. They might be quieter than they normally are. The interaction of the pet with the owner may be altered in either direction. They might be quieter than normal, or they might be more anxious than normal. They may appear depressed. Their appetite might be reduced. And in cats, it's even more subtle, because cats are a little bit closer to their wild ancestors even than dogs are. And if you think about an animal in the wild, it's evolved to hide pain. Because if it shows pain, then it stands out as a weakling, and it's more likely to be caught by a predator. So there's a very strong natural instinct there to try and conceal pain.
Yeah, there's a famous poem. I never saw a wild thing sorry for itself. A small bird could drop dead frozen from a bough without ever having felt sorry for itself. So there's no display of any kind of problem or issue.
Absolutely.
Can't afford to show
weakness. And in cats, very often it's very subtle. Arthritis in cats, for example, I mean, for a long time people would say that cats don't really get arthritis. It's not they don't get arthritis, it's that we don't recognize it as much. If a dog has arthritis, it's sometimes very obvious. They tend to limp, they're very stiff. When they come back for the walks, you can see them stiff afterwards. Where in a cat, chronic pain like arthritic pain may simply manifest them altering their own habits. You know, the cat who used to jump up and lie on the windowsill on a warm day maybe doesn't do that anymore because he finds jumping painful. So sometimes the changes in behaviour are very subtle. So that's a challenge in recognising pain in animals. And even, you know, with veterinary or human healthcare professionals, we can be the worst in the world sometimes at forgetting to recognise pain or forgetting to be aware and recognise when we might induce pain. And so you've got to be very careful to understand that when we interfere with an animal, particularly surgically, no matter how minor that surgery is, it's going to cause a painful stimulus. And so we've got to be very mindful of that. And we've got to look at, as well as recognising when pain occurs, we have to look at how we can best treat that. And there are some old wives' tales that are still about in terms of pain control. One of them is that, you know, pain is good because it limits activity. And there's a grain of truth in that. If you look at a wild animal, acute pain, which is what we might call real pain, insofar as acute pain is something which happens when there is tissue damage, and when healing has completed, the pain goes away. Which is different to chronic pain. Chronic pain is pain that goes on even after the healing has stopped. So it's almost like a false pain. But with acute pain in the wild, acute pain will certainly limit the animal's activity, and it'll alert the animal to the fact there's something wrong. It'll reduce their activity level and help to improve and maximise the potential for healing. But in domesticated animals, we don't have to use pain to limit their activity. We can limit their activity. So if we have an animal that's just had surgery, for example, we can restrict its movement. We don't have to let the pain restrict it. So there shouldn't be any inhibition to using painkillers. And painkillers should always be used early, and painkillers should always be used aggressively. It's another wise tale that maybe if you use painkillers too early, they get used to them and they'll be no good later on. That's also not true. So we recognise nowadays, particularly with managing surgical pain, that we use what we call preemptive pain relief, and that we give the painkillers before the surgery starts, not afterwards. We also understand in recent times how pain works and how the brain reacts to pain, because pain is not just the sensation of the stimulus, but the upper brain, the higher brain centres, and the emotional state of the brain actually comes into play in how we perceive pain, because pain is a combination of a sensory input, and it's also combined with an emotional state and an emotional reaction to that pain. And the body has the ability to amplify pain. So when you inflict a painful stimulus, and say it's a surgical pain or if it's an accidental pain, a broken leg, the actual tissue that's damaged will cause firing of the nerve endings that are damaged. But also the nerve endings in the surrounding area become sensitized to pain and any further reaction. And that causes an amplification of pain, what we call peripherally, around the site of pain. But when those messages go up the spinal cord and into the brain, along the way within the spinal cord and within the brain itself, if the pain continues, the body amplifies the signal. That's what we call wind-up of pain. And so we recognize that if you leave pain alone and you don't treat it early on,
so you're going to get this amplification.
You get amplification.
But hang on now, you're saying that, right, and I'm listening to you. And I'm thinking, so you give the painkiller, you give it to a person, you give it to a dog, give it to a cat, it doesn't matter. And it blocks the signals coming up, because that's what the painkiller does in effect. It stops the pain signals coming to the brain, so you don't feel the pain. It's not dealing with the problem, all right? It's not correct, is it not? Am I right in saying that? You fracture your leg. Mm. The painkiller isn't fixing your leg. Okay, it's just stopping the pain, correct?
Absolutely.
So you take something else that might help you with the recovery there.
Yeah.
If you do that, then the animal thinks I'm okay. I can leap around the place. I'm not feeling the pain. Isn't there a likelihood it's going to do more damage? Well, that's why I often wondered about the pain, even when I'm taking it myself for my back or something like that. I think, well, I'm going to do stuff now. I have a lot of pain. I'm going to take these painkillers. The pain is going to go away. I'm going to do all the stuff that actually irritates it and makes it worse. Am I mad?
Well, that's where the owner comes into play. In a human, you can explain to the person that, you know, we're giving you painkillers, we're going to take the pain away, but you're not supposed to use your leg. And here's the amount of activity you can do, and here's what you can't do. So the owner has to be educated and advised as to what they can do. So, for example, if an animal has an orthopedic surgery to fix its broken leg and it's had a bone plate put in there, then we can explain to the owner how much activity that animal should have. Zero activity is actually bad. Some activity and some physiotherapy is actually good for healing. But the owner then can restrict that animal. And so, for example, if an animal, had a dog in this morning now, has had an operation on his cruciate ligament. So when he goes home now this evening, we'll explain to the owner that for the first 3 weeks after surgery, he can be taken outside into the garden on a lead to go to the toilet, come back in, and then stay in the house. So for the first 3 weeks, the owner will restrict the activity to that level. Next 3 weeks, he'll get a little bit more activity. Next 3 weeks, he'll get more again. So we actually give an activity schedule to the owner. So you can control the amount of activity your dog has so that you don't need the pain to control it. And now you're free to use pain control. So you can actually block the pain out completely. But then you have to take the responsibility, because the animal, you're quite correct, the animal won't understand once you take the pain away that it shouldn't, you know, be too active. So you have to intervene and restrict it. And it doesn't apply just to pets, even to farm animals. You can stable an animal while it's recovering to reduce its activity. So we can actually control the activity and therefore are completely free to use pain control so they don't have to suffer the pain.
Now, the other kind of pain is a kind of mental torture. You mentioned depression in animals. How would you know if a dog is depressed? And how do you treat that depression? Do you give it Anxicam?
Yeah. No, very rarely. I mean, in a very, very small number of circumstances, anti-anxiety drugs are used in pets, but it's only in limited circumstances. You've got to be very, very careful you don't overuse them or abuse them. I mean, animals can become depressed. They can come depressed when somebody in the house moves away. You know, somebody goes off to college or moves away and the family has changed. They can become depressed. They can become depressed when they move house. They can become depressed when they lose another pet in the house. If you have two dogs and one dies, the other dog can quite often become depressed. So animals certainly can become depressed and they can become stressed. And again, you tend to see it in their behaviour. They can't explain it, but you'll see it in their behaviour. They tend to become lethargic. Their demeanour changes and how they normally interact with their owner changes. But it does occur, and in most cases you can change that by identifying what was the trigger factor and then trying to change that rather than using drugs. It's very rare. There are a certain small number of situations where we do use anti-anxiety drugs. Dogs who suffer, for example, from separation anxiety. There are some dogs who react very badly when they're left on their own and get very, very anxious. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, we can use, for short periods of time, we can use anxiolytic drugs, which relieve anxiety for a short period of time, but in parallel with training and changes to the lifestyle of the dog. So it's a temporary crutch. They're not used long term in animals.
So what's this report saying?
The report is saying it's reiterating how you recognise pain, and it's also giving a lot of technical information to give to people all of the available painkillers that can be used, what dosage they can be used at, and because across the world, there's great disparity and diversity across the world in terms of the state of development of the veterinary profession in different countries and also the way people keep animals. So what it's doing is putting into one place and one online document a very comprehensive
protocol.
Yeah. It's protocol, and it'll run through different surgical procedures and recommended protocols for pain relief for different surgical procedures and different clinical situations, what level of pain you should expect
based on
the
years of
disease.
Study and observation and research.
It is. They brought together a panel of experts from around the world who are experts in pain control and anaesthesia, and they've gathered together all that information into one place that's easy to access, put into a format that it's very easy to look up and use. So if you get a dog coming in who has a slip disc and you want to know what sort of pain relief you should use for that, you can look this up, get a list of all the drugs that can be used for it and the dosages that can be given, and also look at the combinations of painkillers that you can use, because we sometimes use more than one painkiller to maximise the effect. So it's giving a technical reference for people. But it also serves the purpose of simply putting into people's minds, putting pain in the front of vets' minds to keep reminding us to think about pain in everything we do, think about pain control. So it's awareness as well as a technical resource.
And is that available for everybody, Andrew, or is it just vets?
It's actually online. I don't think it's restricted. It's on an online library, and I don't think it's restricted.
Okay, so we'll put a link, if we can, on our website, because it would be very interesting for pet owners maybe to have a little glance of it.
Yes, indeed. I'll look up the link to it.
I don't think it's
restricted. I don't see any reason why it would need to be.
We're going to take a break, and then we want to talk to some people who want to talk to you. But I was in Spain recently, and I noticed everywhere 24-hour veterinary care. Are you aware of this? Every street you walk down, there was a vet that was open or on call 24 hours. Yeah. And it's the big cross. Was it a green cross or what colour was it?
Yeah, they tend to use a green cross.
Green cross, kind of illuminated cross outside. And I thought, they care more about pets than they do about people. Are we open 24 hours? I mean, are you guys open?
We have 24. Vets are on call in one way or another 24 hours, whether it's the individual practice or practices grouping together. In the Dublin area here now, for example, most of the practices on the south side of the city have grouped together to have a 24-hour intensive care unit which is located within UCD. That's open at night time when we're closed. And that's staffed then by vets and nurses who specialise in emergency care through the night, so that if your pet goes in there with an emergency during the night, there are people there up and awake on the night shift who are there to look after them throughout the night.
But even the amount of clinics and surgeries I saw all around the place, so many of them, I thought these people must... And yet, I didn't see lots of cats and dogs.
Yeah, you do. Well, Spain is a pet... There's a huge pet population in Spain. You do notice that. And the density of veterinary clinics in Spain is quite high. You do see many, many clinics. And I've noticed that myself in Spain. You don't have to travel very far. Almost at every second street corner, you'll see a small veterinary clinic.
There were, yeah. I was just wondering about it here. Anyway, look, Andrew's staying with us. So email mooney@rte.ie or text 51551. Tons of questions coming in, and we'll get to them after this break. Anyway, let's get back to Andrew Byrne. John O'Halloran. John, sorry for keeping you waiting. Go ahead. Andrew's there.
Hi, Andrew. It's John O'Halloran here.
Hello, John.
I'm just wondering, Andrew, I have a six-month-old pup. He's a cross between a Bernese Mountain Dog and a Golden Retriever. And I was out walking him recently, and I happened to come across a woman who told me that he had two dew claws on his hind legs. And she said they really should come off. And I'm thinking to myself, should they or shouldn't they? I know they're kind of an artificial like thumb on a dog, but should I actually consider having them taken off is really my question for him.
No, it's a very good question, John, because years ago it used to be traditional to remove dew claws and remove tails when puppies were very young. And we've just been talking about pain control, and because that's
tail
luckily
docking.
Been banned, tail
Not
docking,
nice.
Because it was very, very painful.
Yeah.
Nowadays, with dew claws, Most dew claws don't need to be removed. There are some that do. There are some dogs who have dew claws that stick out at an angle and they continuously get caught in things. Mm-hmm. And if that's happening and they're getting repeated injuries, or it looks like the shape or conformation of the dew claw is such that they are going to continually get caught or torn, then we will remove them. And removal, when it is done, is carried out under a general anaesthetic. If it's identified as a problem in a young dog, say around about 6 months of age, if they're going to be neutered anyway, then it's sometimes carried out at the time of neutering. I would say that most dew claws don't need to be removed. Most are fine. Most are usually close to the foot. And in fact, we really don't often see injuries with dew claws. The other type of problem you can get with dew claws is because the nail is not in contact with the ground, it just needs to be clipped occasionally.
Okay.
Every maybe 3 to 6 months. But just regular clipping of the dew nail will solve that problem. So I'm a little bit conservative about removing them because it's a reasonably big surgery for them. Some dew claws have a bony attachment like our thumb. Some don't. The ones that don't have a bony attachment, the surgery is much simpler for them. But generally, I only tend to remove them if they're sticking out at an unusual angle where they are likely to get caught. But if it's nice and neat, close to the paw and not sticking out at a funny angle, I think it'd be absolutely fine. Maybe next time you're in with your vet, just let them have a look at it and see what they think. And then they could advise you. And if he or she, your puppy?
It's a he. Yeah.
If he hasn't been neutered already, and if that's something you're considering doing, if the dew claw needed to be removed, it could be perhaps done at the same time. But next time you're in, let your vet have a look at it. But I'm generally a bit conservative. I don't remove them unless they're really sticking out and likely to cause problems.
Okay, listen, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. May I ask another question? Neutering, should I do it or not? I'm in a quandary.
No, I would. I've neutered my own dog, I always have. I think with male dogs, I think it is worthwhile neutering. And there's a couple of reasons for neutering a male dog. I mean, population control, of course, is one. But for the individual dog, temperament and behaviour generally tends to be better in dogs who are neutered than unneutered. And there are also certain medical conditions that are less common when they're neutered. So diseases affecting the prostate gland and little tumours around the anus, diseases like that are less common when they're neutered. So personally, I'm in favour of neutering, and I tend to recommend neutering most male dogs between 6 or 9 months of age.
Brent has been on to say, "Hi, my dog has a morbid fear of the vet. He only has to put his telescope," I think she means stethoscope. Stethoscope on her tummy and she screams. It's really bad. My fear is she could have a heart attack. Any advice?
It's like us going to
stethoscope with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really any different to some people. For example, have a terrible fear of dentists, and I used to hate dentists and got over it eventually. It's very, very difficult. I mean, some dogs who are very, very anxious about coming, you can give them sedative tablets before they come. What's better to try and do is to see if it's possible to give them a treat as soon as they've come out of the surgery, and also to maybe take them a short walk beforehand and a short walk immediately afterwards. So to do something fun around it so that it doesn't just become an ordeal without a reward. So short walk beforehand, bring a treat with you to give them on the way out and take them for their favourite walk immediately afterwards, and just try and break down the anxiety. Another thing you can do is sometimes maybe if the vet's surgery is not too far away from you, go down to it now and again when you're not going in. And just go past the gate, or even walk into the car park and go back out again, and just sometimes go there when nothing is happening. Or if you're going down to pick up wormers or pick up food, bring your dog with you just to get them used to coming in and going back out again when nothing terrible happens to them. And that'll try and build up their confidence.
Any ideas on how to bring my small dog to the beach? What? You want to bring your
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. I mean, dogs, I suppose at this time of year, we've got to be careful. We've got to be responsible about this because there are lots of people on the beach. First thing is make absolutely sure you've got something with you to pick up poo if you have any accidents. Be careful to check that pets are allowed on the beach and to keep them on a lead when you're on the beach this time of year, because even if they're very well behaved when they're running around, people can be frightened by them. But generally speaking, dogs love the beach. If it's be careful in hot weather, they don't get overheated. Mm-hmm. But I mean, dogs love the beach. Swimming is great exercise for them. Just be careful about them eating any dead fish or seaweed they pick up, and if their paws get clogged up with sand, wash the feet when they come home. But do be careful, just check that they are allowed on the beach before you go.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed.